Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
So, welcome. Thanks for taking the collective mind of the current financial crisis to come along and talk about what happened a long time ago. So it's good to have Sandra Hall back at the Sydney Institute. I think this is her third appearance here. So I will introduce her briefly. She's well known for film reviews, of course, published in the Sydney Morning Herald and before that in the Bulletin. In 2006, her fourth estate published her book, Beyond the Break, which was longlisted for the 2007 Miles Franklin Literary Award. She's also the author of another novel, A Thousand Small Wishes, and two books dealing with the history of Australian television, Super Tory and Turning On, Turning Off. In a collection of their reviews, Critical Business, the New Australian Cinema Review, was published in 1985. With Sandra Hall's here today on the occasion of the publication of their most recent book, Tabloid Man, The Life and Times of Ezra Norton. And here today she's going to talk to us on Ezra Norton, his life and times. Sandra, many thanks.
Well, I sort of wonder sometimes at how casually I went into this book. I hope you can all hear me. I've got a notoriously soft voice.
If you can't hear folks, just yell out, okay?
I just about finished a novel and I thought I'd like to sort of get out of the house and have a project which entails some research. I didn't realise it was going to keep me more or less occupied for the next 5 years. Anyway, it did. It was curiosity that got me going, that and a lifelong fascination with tabloid newspapers. I was 16 when it started. That was when I went to work on The Sun as a copy girl, straight from school. From then on, I was hooked. I got my cadetship 18 months later. Not that I was any good at the job at all, far from it. I lived in terror half the time, dreading the prospect of being sent out on some story where I'd have to door knock people and ask them obnoxious questions. My idea of a perfect working day was to sit in the office and eavesdrop on other reporters who really did know what they were doing. Most of them were great characters and quite a few of them have found their way into the book. Ezra Norton was just a name to me at that stage. By then he'd sold his papers, Truth and the Daily Mirror, and he'd retired. He'd never been as well known as the Packers and the Fairfaxes anyway, always a bit of a mystery man. I knew he was the son of the notorious John Norton. I knew about Wild Men of Sydney, Cyril Pearl's very witty and very scathing account of John Norton's career. And I'd vaguely heard that Ezra tried to have the book banned, which seemed to the height of hypocrisy coming as it did from someone who made his fortune out of exposing other people's scandals via Truth. Then a little later, through my friendship with the journalist and poet Elizabeth Riddell, I learned a few more things about him. Her newspaper life began when she was hired by the Norton Press in New Zealand and brought over to work on Truth in Sydney, and it was the beginning of a great career. During World War II, Ezra sent her to work in the London Bureau, and later she went on to New York to open an office for him there, which was really something if you consider that the Sydney Morning Herald was still declining to employ women as news reporters as late as the 1960s. So there must have been something to him, I thought, and then I forgot about him for another 20 years. By then, some great books had been done about Australian newspaper tycoons. Gavin Souter, Bridget Griffin Foley and Paul Barry had done definitive books on the Fairfaxes and the Packers. There'd been a biography of Sir Keith Murdoch, and his son Rupert seemed to spark a new biography every few years, but absolutely nothing on Ezra. And that was strange, I thought, because his retirement was the catalyst which sparked the breakthrough in Rupert Murdoch's early career. He made his entree into the Sydney market by taking over the Norton papers. So I got going, and it wasn't easy, but it was fascinating. First up, I found that the late Richard Hall, another journalist, no relation, had made a start on a book about Ezra. Then he'd set it aside to work on something else. His agent, Rose Creswell, as executor of Dick's estate, kindly gave me access to his papers in the National Library. And that was a terrific help. The stumbling block, however, was Dick's handwriting, which was only occasionally legible. Tantalising glimpses of Ezra's early life emerged, then the trail would go dead in a sort of spidery dribble. But I did get some valuable clues, and they became a touchstone for stuff I'd eventually get from other sources. The key to understanding anything about Ezra, I discovered, was his childhood. John Norton put his family through hell. For a start, he was a relentless self-publiciser, usually through Truth, which he helped establish in the 1890s. He didn't found the paper. It was the baby of two other rowdies in the New South Wales Parliament, William Willis and Paddy Crick, who later got into trouble in the New South Wales land scandals. But Norton put some money into the paper and he became its editor. He was a genius as a newspaper man, when sober, but more often than not he wasn't sober, that is. And during his drinking binges, he was likely to do anything. He was in his office firing his revolver in the air shortly before he himself was fired by Willis and Crick. Needless to say, it didn't go quietly. He and his former business partners took to suing one another, and the litigation went on for 3 years. Their brawls became a great source of entertainment to the rest of the Sydney press. But without Norton, Truth began to flounder. And to cut a very long and very complicated story short, Norton eventually got control of the paper and made it his own in every possible sense. He used it to turn himself into the hero and the villain of a mythology which kept Truth's tens of thousands of readers in thrall for 20 years. Between 1896 and 1916, he used the paper to advance his political career, championing his favourite causes, castigate his enemies and indulge his biases, which embraced racism and anti-Semitism. He claimed to have invented the word wowser, and he chronicled his daily routine in his open letters, which might cover everything, starting with what he had for breakfast. So when I first began researching Tabloid Man, I thought I'd briefly summarise all this. It had been already very well covered in Wild Men of Sydney and in Michael Cannon's book. I don't know whether you've read it. It's called That Damn Democrat. But once I got into Truth's archives and started reading, I just couldn't stop. Much of what I read dealt with Norton's rocky marriage to Ezra's mother, Ada. He was often violent towards her, and she left him several times. Yet the marriage endured for 18 years, a kind of folie à deux, I think, because Ada did fight back. I think her temperament was as theatrical as Norton's. How else could you put up with the fact that your husband publicised your marital rows by running accounts of them in his own newspapers? At one stage, Norton gave over page 5 of Truth to successive episodes in the drama. We think the soap opera was invented only 50 years ago. Well, let me tell you, John Norton thought of it long before that. He even had a standing headline for these stories. They ran under the heavily sarcastic line, John Norton's Appy Ohm, missing the H's. One particularly lurid episode in the series centred on Ada's row with her maidservant, Mary Byrne, a very large and brawny Irish woman. Ada was living away from Norton at this stage in Edgecliff Road, Willara, with Mary. But one night they had a huge falling out, and Ada's mother, who was said to be no wider than one of Mary's arms, happened to get in the way. Well, the ensuing brawl raised the neighbours, and Truth's following report was headed, Mary Bangs Ada with Boot. Nonetheless, she eventually went back to him. The marriage lasted for another 14 years. Then when finally she did sue him for divorce, he had the court proceedings covered in full, again in Truth. And they make extraordinary reading. Well, Ezra was 18 at the time all this was going on, the divorce, and he went with his mother to court every day. Yet even after all that, I think he had a conflicted view of his father. Norton seems to have been one of those people who had a carrot and stick approach to parenting. One minute he'd be abusing Ezra, then he'd sober up and write him fulsomely affectionate letters. As a result, Ezra was still defending him decades afterwards, even refusing to accept his alcoholism, which again was extraordinary considering the fact that Ada and Ezra found they'd been disinherited when Norton died in 1916. Most of his wealth had been left to Ezra's 9-year-old sister, Joan. Fortunately for them both, however, Ada's lawyers had very influential connections, and thanks to their intervention, the New South Wales Parliament hurried through a bill that it had on its books for a while. It was called the Testator's Family Maintenance and Education of Infants Bill, and it was designed to assist spouses and children in precisely Ada's and Ezra's predicament, and Norton's will was eventually overturned. So there are abundant reasons why he should have developed such a fetish about his own privacy. But it did make it hard for me, his would-be biographer. He left no diaries, no letters, not even any public speeches. He'd do anything to avoid making one of those. When his horse won the Melbourne Cup, he stayed in Sydney. If he'd gone to accept the cup himself, he would have had to make a speech. He was not exactly a quiet man, however. The journalists who worked for him could testify to that. He inherited his father's love of the colourful curse, and the air often turned blue during one of his so-called boning and gutting sessions. These were the post-mortems conducted after a mistake had been made. Anyone who'd laid so much as a finger on the offending piece of copy was called in and given a blast, and usually the senior editors suffered the most. He was also a remarkably quick learner. I could find no evidence that he spent much time at school. A few years at Scots College, perhaps even less, when he was very young. The headmaster at the time was the Reverend Aspinall, who abhorred the larrikin element in Sydney society and would certainly have been no fan of the Nortons. And certainly it's very clear that Ezra had an extremely hard time at the school. He was bullied and he hated it. And as far as I could find out, he didn't go to school again until he was 21. This time it was Waverley College, and which he did enjoy. Apparently it wasn't uncommon for young men of his age to be at the school. Some had been in the workforce and had come back to get better qualifications. And a bit later there were ex-soldiers coming back to catch up on the education they'd missed. Yet this period at school didn't really explain how he could step so easily into the role of newspaper proprietor. Because in 1922, at the age of 25, he took control of Truth. And he made an immediate success of it. The circulation started to rise just about as soon as he took over. He was not a writer. There were no more open letters, nor were the paper's editorials written by him, but they did reflect his views. And in many respects, they were not so different from his father's. Truth had always been seen as a working man's paper, and it remained that way. It offered a gamey mix of crime, divorce, sex, sport, and a rather more pragmatic form of populism than the old John Norton brand. A few traditional themes persisted. The paper's unabashed racism was one of them. It also went on exposing medical quackery, a particular sort of preoccupation of the Nortons, I don't know why. But Ezra had other passions as well. He hated cruelty to animals. He was obsessed with cleanliness. He mounted a series of public health campaigns, and he fervently supported a ban on the export of merino sheep. This was to protect the Australian wool market. So he was a strong-willed character and a very idiosyncratic one. There were plenty of anecdotes about him, luckily, and I was fortunate enough to find those who could talk about them. I heard a lot more about his obsession with hygiene. He liked his office doorknob polished with disinfectant after anyone had dared touch it with dirty hands. He used to place a blotter on his desk so anybody who came into the office would touch the blotter rather than the desk. And after they'd gone, the page was from the blotter was removed and another one, fresh one, was put in its place. That's one of his secretaries, sort of most, she had to be very assiduous about that. And he had superstitions. He once paid for a passenger liner to be laid over in Sydney Harbour for 24 hours just because he wouldn't travel on Friday the 13th. And I heard about his long-running feud with Frank Packer, which climaxed in 1939 with a fist fight in the members' enclosure at Randwick Racecourse. Read more of that in a minute. But I guess the book is as much about Ezra's times as the man himself. This is partly because he was so elusive and partly because his papers really did mirror the mood of working-class Australia during the decades when he was at his most powerful. That was from the 1920s to the 60s. He really started spreading his wings in the late 1930s. Truth had suffered a bit of a dip during the Depression, but so did a lot of other Sydney papers. It was a highly competitive scene and a few of them folded. Truth, however, was never in any danger of that. And after the Depression was over, it really did thrive. So much so that Ezra turned his thoughts to the afternoon newspaper market. which had always been dominated by this Sir Hugh Denison's son. And at first he was very frustrated. The outbreak of war brought newsprint rationing, and his fellow press tycoons lobbied the government very vigorously to block his plans. Frank Packer became a particular enemy. The two men had already made a great practice of sniping at one another. Packer's bigness and loudness would have made him an irresistible target in the eyes of Ezra. As I said, he was famously irascible. But Packer's telegraph fired the first shot by making fun of Truth's equivocal stance on the war. When Poland was invaded, the paper had said Danzig was no concern to Australia and the Poles and Germans should just settle things between themselves. Then shortly after that, it completely changed its mind. By then, Eric Bohm had been hired as its chief war correspondent in Europe, and Bohm had declared he was going to France to the Maginot Line. If he couldn't get there as a correspondent, he thundered he was going to put on a uniform and go as a soldier. What this country needs, he said, was more hate for the Hun. Well, the Telegraph was highly amused by these fulminations and made great play of the contrast between them and what Truth had been saying just 3 weeks earlier. Then Truth published a mocking story about Packer. He'd objected to a photograph of himself that Truth had been going to run, and I must say that it did emphasise the largeness of his ears, and he didn't like it at all. He'd even sent another one in its place. So Ezra gleefully had both pictures published with the headings approved and disapproved and ran a story explaining what had happened. And so the upshot of all this sniping was the punch-up at Randwick, where Packer, surprisingly enough, got the worst of it. He was much bigger than Ezra, and Ezra was quite small, but Packer had been an amateur boxer. But Ezra had a couple of minders with him. Some reports say that they stepped in to break up the brawl. Others say that they just simply joined in. Anyway, Packer emerged from the fray very much the worse for wear, and after that he had no hesitation in joining the other proprietors in their efforts to stop Ezra getting his afternoon newspaper. And for a while they succeeded. The government knocked back his newsprint allocation the first time around, but by 1941, after some very shrewd political manoeuvring, he had what he wanted, and the Daily Mirror was launched as a very serious competitor to the Sun. It also ushered in a new newspaper era. For the next two decades, the cry the newsboys used, the Sun of the Mirror, came to be as familiar to Sydneysiders as the clatter of the trams. And the paper's competing crime reporters would often behave as outrageously as the confidence men they wrote about. Photographers put on white coats to get into hospital wards. Reporters snatched family photographs from crime scenes. And Ezra himself gained a reputation for toughness among those editors and reporters unfortunate enough to be subjected to those boning and gutting sessions. I had to stop myself digressing at times. At one stage, in trying to draw a picture of Sydney in the 1920s, I came dangerously close to devoting nearly half a chapter to the invention of the labour-saving kitchen. And if you want to find out where that fits into the narrative, I'm afraid you'll have to read the book. Then there were the characters who crossed the Norton's paths. Bohm was one, of course. I had a lot of fun researching his wartime career. He set up the Mirror's London office in a suite at the Savoy. Bob Raymond, who went on to have a great career as a documentary maker, worked for him there in his early days in journalism, and he wrote a wonderful memoir of what it was like. Bohm made many of his contacts in the bar downstairs. He also knew Noel Coward, who lived upstairs, and got a lot of information from him. And he'd sometimes bring up these contacts from the bar, elegant figures in evening dress, and he'd show them how a newspaper really worked. He'd even stride around the room dictating stories to the teleprinter operator. But it all came to an abrupt end when Ezra finally settled down one day to examine Bohm's expense account. They quickly moved out of the Savoy. Another character I discovered, I thought I'd read everything there was on John Norton when I went to the Mitchell Library one day and discovered a cache of his letters which had never been published. I still remember how it felt to untie the ribbon on the folder and see those pages with his very black handwriting, very strong handwriting, absolutely no problems with legibility there. How I wish Dick had the same hand. And the letters had been written to a woman called Lala Fisher, one of the literary identities of the day, who was obviously very astute And she must have had a lot of charm as well, because she managed to remain friends with both Nortons, Ada and John, when relations between them were at their most poisonous. She even tried to play the role of peacemaker at one stage, and luckily for me, the diatribe Norton let rip in response was in the letters. And the same week I had another breakthrough as well, thanks to a very generous journalist called John Flower. He gave me access to a treasure trove of papers dealing with the flamboyant H.D. McIntosh. Don't know how much you know about McIntosh, otherwise known as Huge Deal. He first achieved fame as a boxing promoter. He built the Sydney Stadium. Then he went on to buy newspapers as well as setting himself up as a theatrical entrepreneur. He ran the Tivoli circuit for a while. And in the course of all this, he made and lost several fortunes. He was also rash enough to borrow money from Ezra's 22-year-old sister Joan just after she came into her inheritance, which was a big mistake. Ezra made him bankrupt in revenge for that one. Ezra's career as a press baron ended in 1958 when he sold out and retired. Television had arrived. He was worried about his health. He was always worried about his health, but particularly then. And he wanted to ensure a secure future for his young daughter Mary and his wife Peggy. Mary was only 12 at the time. This was his second marriage. His first wife Molly, to whom he was devoted, had died very suddenly in 1952. And there was too his passion for horse racing. His horse Straight Draw had won the Melbourne Cup the year before. I'm told some biographers fall in love with their subjects. This didn't happen to me. But I did find the relationship very rewarding for what it told me about the Australia I grew up in and what it told me about tabloids then and now. For the Norton legacy does persist, I think. A year after Ezra's retirement, Rupert Murdoch, then a fledgling newspaper tycoon based in Adelaide, made his entry into the Sydney and Melbourne markets by buying up the Norton papers. And 50 years later, echoes of the Norton's stridently popular style can still be seen, I think, in Murdoch's papers, that many reminders of John Norton's sort of again the establishment sentiments in Murdoch's London papers, The Sun and the News of the World. In other ways, however, the tabloid landscape has changed completely. In the old days, society maintained certain taboos. Adultery, divorce and homosexuality were frowned upon, which only intensified their fascination to so-called respectable citizens. And this is why, of course, a paper like Truth was able to flourish for so long. Now there are no taboos. Instead, the pendulum has swung the other way, and there's a voyeuristic pressure, I think, on celebrities to expose much of their lives to the public gaze. Mistakes are made and mulled over. Pop stars appear on TV chat shows talking about kicking their drug habits. And the act of confessing their sins is supposed to make them more endearing to all of us. So all very different from the ethos at work in the Norton's day. Yet in a sense, I think things have come full circle. After all, no one pursued the confessional approach more eagerly than John Norton. Just before I finish, I'd like to read a brief passage from the book to give you the flavour of Ezra's personality. Just to set the scene, after the Mirror's launch, he moved out of the Truth and Mirror building down New Central Railway. And set up near here in Hosking House in Penfold Place. And that's where these incidents occurred. To many of those at Hosking House, working for Ezra was like dealing with a bear whose occasional moments of playfulness were as unsettling as his explosions. They both feared and enjoyed him. More indulgent were the women in the office who tended to see his amenable side. This was the Ezra who made sure that sick or injured employees received the best medical care as well as convalescence on full pay. The Ezra who paid for Nancy Gunn's son John to be educated at a private school. Nancy Gunn was Ezra's personal assistant and a very loyal employee for years. He also helped the widow of an employee killed in an accident by paying off her mortgage. Anecdotes abounded. His love of animals was known to everyone. There was the day he came back to the office after his customary lunch at Prince's, leading a stray dog he'd found in the street. And there were some Norton eruptions which would be remembered for years to come. One morning, the building's lift was taking an unusually long time to arrive when Ezra walked in with his chauffeur and was forced to join the group already waiting. When at last the lift came, he shouted at the driver, demanding to know where the bloody hell he'd been. And the driver, who worked for Penfolds, not Truth and Sportsman, explained that he'd been carrying rolls of paper from the top floor and there'd been no room for passengers. Unimpressed, Ezra continued shouting until eventually the driver too lost his temper. "Walk up the stairs, you bastard," he yelled, and slammed the door in Ezra's face. Left no alternative, he stamped up the stairs and for the next 6 weeks refused to use the lift. Then one morning, he stepped inside as if nothing had happened and cordially asked the driver to take him up to his office. Most of these stories had an element of farce, although at the time it was barely discernible to those who were part of the action. One example was the payroll incident. The company had a weekly payroll of £20,000, a substantial sum in the 1940s, and its distribution involved a strict routine. The money would be withdrawn in cash from the commercial banking company in Martin Place and brought back by car in a large tin box covered in a canvas slipcover. It would be then put into pay packets and returned to the bank until payday. Essential to this ritual was the presence of one of the company's directors. He would travel in the car to the bank with two men from the pay office and the cash, armed with a pistol kept especially for the job. On this particular occasion, the pay office clerks and the available director, who happened to be deaf, came downstairs to find that the car was not in its usual place. Spying one of the company's fleet of Dodgers parked nearby, they headed across. The director got in, turned off his hearing aid, and sat gazing idly at the traffic. The cash box was loaded and the clerks were just about to get in when Ezra arrived and furiously ordered them out of his car. By now an audience was gathering, but the director, who was still looking the other way, remained oblivious until Ezra leaned in and yelled in his ear. The director jumped and explained that they'd assumed the car was for them, a serious tactical error. Seizing on the word assumed, Ezra pointed at an approaching tram and said, "If you assume it's going to stop and you go out and stand in the middle of the tram tracks, you'll go arse over tits." Then, warming to his theme, he noticed the bulge of the pistol that the director was carrying in his pocket and added a cautionary note about his bloody arse being blown off if the gun fired accidentally. He and his driver then got into the car and left director and pay clerks standing in the midst of the city crowds with £20,000. Shortly afterwards, he calmed down. Thank you.
Thanks, Sandra. So we come to question and discussion. Janet Grundy's got some copies of Tabloid Man, The Life and Times of Ezra Pound. Sorry. He was also mad, I think it's true to say. Ezra Norton, I'm sorry. Ezra. It's not a. Anne and I grew up in Melbourne, and proprietors down there, we were saying earlier, were all gentlemen, and they. Sir David Simon, Sir Keith Murdoch, and we didn't have any of these sort of types down there. But he was a bit of a gambler too, wasn't he? Because he ended up sort of taking a bet on Catholicism. What was that all about? Why did he end up signing up with Rome?
Well, the Truth and Mirror.
If you just talk to the back of the room.
Okay. Truth and Mirror were always sort of thought of as Catholic papers for some reason. He was kind of sympathetic to Catholicism, and he gave quite large amounts of money to St. Vincent's Hospital. And he used to say that he always hired Catholic reporters because whatever they did, they could go to confession and start all over again the following week. But John Norton had always had a passionate kind of hatred of English Protestantism for some reason. He was really an Orange, Irish, you know, the Orangemen as well. I don't know why. So there was a sort of streak of sympathy running through the family for Catholicism. And when Ezra was on his deathbed, he actually converted. And I think one of those instrumental in his conversion was Sister Bernice, who only died really recently. I didn't get to talk to her, unfortunately, because she was too ill when I started on the book. But I think she might have had a story to tell. Yeah.
Years ago, when I did history at Sydney University, I picked up the idea, which is probably wrong, that the reason why there's such strong defamation laws in New South Wales was because of Norton, that his pressure on the state government. I don't know whether that's true or not.
Well, there was a when Cyril Pearl's book was published while in Sydney, he did he really lobbied hard for the book to be banned, and he found a few sympathetic parliamentarians who wanted to bring the law. Well, they said all they wanted to do was put in writing what already existed in spirit, you know. And it's a sort of foggy issue. You can write what, you know, as long as you don't defame descendants of those people who've died, you can write more or less what you like. But if what you say about them can be construed as a sort of reflection on those, their descendants or anyone living, then the defamation law comes into play. There was a huge debate at the time about it when... and in fact, I'm told from papers I found left by his secretary that he got as many of the books he could find and had them burned, that everybody, all the loyal Nortonians, as she called them, got together and went out and bought, you know, as many books as they could find in the bookshops and joined together, and they burned them.
Alan?
Have you got a story in the book about a character called the Claw?
This is Philip Knightley's story, isn't it?
I can't remember who told you. It was so out of this world.
Yes, I didn't include it, actually, because I'm still not quite sure. I know it's a story Philip Knightley tells, and I'm not quite secure enough in whether I believe it or not to have put it in the book.
Well, tell us what it is.
Well, Philip Knightley was a news reporter on Truth, on the Mirror, rather, before he went to London. And I just have a sort of sketchy memory of this, but he made up a character who travelled around on public transport with a claw for a hand, and used to raise women's dresses with the claw. And he wrote a big story about this, which was published in the paper. I think I've got it right. But later confessed, never got found out at the time that he made this character up.
So the version that I heard was, you know, any time the newspaper was short on a story,
yes,
they just
right.
put something in about the claw on the rampage of, you know, the vagabond
yes.
et cetera, et cetera.
I'm just not sure where this
one
is.
Day, one day, a policeman rang the paper. And there was only one journalist in the office at the time. He said, we've caught him, we've got the claw. So I can't remember what the outcome explained it away.
Yes, I'm just not sure whether it's...
Sounds like the story is completely true, except for the facts. But the rest of it's terrific. Michael.
Sandra, you mentioned Uncle Eric.
That's Eric right. Bain. You, in fact, was great at help.
I've always found it curious, and I've never worked out why... Norton employed such an egomaniac as my uncle, not once, but twice.
Yes.
And sacked him twice for more money. He was paid more money not to work than I think I had ever been paid at the Fairfax organisation to work, which was humiliating. Why did Norton have this funny relationship with Eric Bohm? It's defeated me.
Yes, I don't really know either. Obviously, he admired the flair and thought he, you know, despite everything that he was able to attract terrific, because he did break some terrific stories, didn't he, during World War II, and he obviously had some great contacts, partly through the Savoy. But I think Norton, when he perceived that anybody got too big for their boots, then he'd like to administer a very sharp sort of slap, and I think that happened, certainly that happened with Eric, twice, but then he did bring him back to edit, to start the Sunday Mirror when they retired the Truth masthead and tried to introduce a more sort of family-oriented newspaper with the Sunday Mirror. And I think Eric Bohm was very tough on himself when he said what a disaster, you know, that the paper was, because, you know, it doesn't seem to me to have been so bad. It didn't succeed, but some of it was a sort of cut above what the Sundays were publishing at that time, I think.
Question there? Yeah.
You talked before about Packer and Murdoch and they become dynasties. Tell us why the Nortons have become dynasties.
Yes, partly I think because there was nobody to carry on. You know, he only had Mary, his daughter, who was 12 at the time. he died. And partly because I think he knew that his time had gone. You know, he knew he wouldn't get a television license. All the proprietors were doing their very best to sort of project themselves as responsible citizens when the television licenses were issued, and they were all, you know, making very pompous announcements about what they would do with the television station. And he made a sort of cursory attempt you know, he had a barrister appear for him at the licensing hearings, but there was no show of him getting one, and he knew that, I think. And the whole game was changing, you know. Truth was still running in Melbourne and in Brisbane, but Sydney, its time had gone, and the Mirror too had lost circulation to the Sun. So I just think he sort of got out when he could. He's very much a man of his time, I think.
Robert.
And then related to the dynasty aspect, I'm intrigued about his will. It seemed quite complex. He divided his estate into 120 parts. His daughter got 29 and 28 parts, one of those if she looked after her mother in the correct way.
Right.
Was it, in fact, quite complex?
Was
this the way that wills were done? What's the reason behind it?
Well, the most ingenious thing was to have it arranged in Canberra, where he wouldn't be subject to the taxes that the will would have attracted in New South Wales. And in fact, they sort of moved to close a loophole in the law, I think. But I think, yes, he was always very sort of meticulous about money, and I think that was all done to make sure his wife and child were properly cared for. Yeah.
And a fairly complex mechanism
it is. Yes, I'm just not sure about why it would have needed to be quite that complicated. His wife had relatives too that she wanted looked after as well, and they got some of the money too.
The demise of the Ritzy Rag newspaper in Australia I find interesting because Britain sort of still got it. I can't remember the what's the name of the one? The Sun, is it? The one that comes out in the evening in Britain.
That's Murdoch.
It's just it's part fiction, part non-fiction, part page three girl or something. You know, it's sort of the bar end of town, you know, evening entertainment. And they've got TV and they've got radio and all the rest of it. What does it say about Australia that we lost it? That we've changed? We're not so British anymore? Or that we're just not as varied as other places?
I think it's probably the people who run the newspapers. I mean, Murdoch is the inheritor of the Norton legacy, and he chose to do what the Nortons had done here in London and in New York. You see it in the New York Post as well, and that sort of sparked a whole new newspaper war in New York when Murdoch went over, because the New York Daily News is, you know, they're both outrageous. They run these incredible headlines, as do the Sun and the News of the World.
Or is it our levels? What's the reason? Because we've had it. I mean, it's kind of like...
Well, the afternoon... The sort of steam's gone out of the afternoon newspaper market as well. I mean, the afternoon newspapers died, and that was where it really flourished. You know, people bought it on the way home, and, you know, they sort of... Now there's no place for that. You know, people are reading the internet. They're updating their news all the time through the day. And... I mean, there's still an element of it in the Telegraph in the mornings, and probably in Melbourne in the Herald Sun. I'm just not as familiar with current Melbourne papers. Yes.
You say that Murdoch inherited the Norton tradition, but why did he not inherit his father's tradition? And what was the relationship between Murdoch and the young Murdoch and Norton?
Well, not much of a relationship. They didn't. I think they met a few times. They didn't really know one another too well. One interesting thing is that Nancy Gunn, who was the mother of the aviation writer John Gunn, she met Norton first when she came out to Australia in the 1920s as a war widow with her young son, and she worked in an accountancy firm before coming here. And she went in to be interviewed for a job in newspapers. She sort of wanted a change, wanted something more adventurous, and was interviewed by Norton. She had no idea who he was, yet they got on tremendously well. And And, you know, he said, would you always tell me the truth? I've got a flaming temper. Would you always, you know, tell me when I'm need to be pulled up? And she said, yes, I'd always do that, and I'll certainly tell you if you swear at me, you know, tell you off. And anyway, their relationship persisted for years. She was seconded by General MacArthur's staff during the war. But after the war, she came back and she helped sort of organise the extensions of the building in, when after the mural was launched, in the building in Central Railway. And then when Murdoch came to Sydney, it was Nancy Gunn who became his secretary, or, you know, his personal assistant. And there are letters from Murdoch and from Dame Elizabeth in Nancy Gunn's papers saying, you know, what a great help she'd been to Murdoch when he first came to Sydney, in sort of smoothing his way and, you know, kind of smartening him up for the Sydney scene. So that was... But Norton, I don't think he wouldn't have sort of thought of Norton as a mentor or anything, I don't think, but certainly the papers would have... The vigour, the energy that had been in the papers would have, you know, been something he admired.
Yes,
my mother nursed in Dame Nellie Melba's house in the 1920s and got great respect for Melba and Coombe Cottage. And she was always furious because Norton used to say in his papers that Nellie Melba was an alcoholic.
Yeah,
my mother used to say, how could she sing so beautifully at an advanced age if she was an alcoholic? And my mother saw no sign of alcoholism.
No.
Hated him for that.
No, she used to lecture him. He sort of lectured her for drinking too much champagne, which was really something coming from him. Yeah, he had no compunction about sort of, you know, writing these letters, which, you know...
Well, he didn't publish it in the paper. I mean, my mother seemed to think it was in truth.
It was, in these open letters he wrote, you know. He'd criticise anybody who decided to... Mm. And really, you know, yeah. Strong language and amazing sort of letters they are.
But she lived in Melbourne, didn't she?
Yes.
There was the Melbourne Truth, too.
Oh, yeah. But he was writing from Sydney.
No, he used to travel all over the country. Uh-huh. It was published nationally.
I've heard stories from people over the years that Norton used to ring people up prior to publishing and threaten them that he was going to publish a story and extort from them.
That's quite probable, actually.
Have you actually established it?
No. Well, I have. I've spoken to people who sort of suggest that, you know, these certain, you know, they don't say threats, but certain implication, you know, intimations were made.
But there's really no evidence of...
There's no, it's all...
...going into the office.
Oh, none of that, no. It was none of that, I don't think. It was just a sort of, you know, warning that... I think politicking, basically, you know, if they wanted something like the newsprint allocation or something from the government, might have happened.
We go Alan and then Michael.
I understand that... I haven't had time to look at it yet, but there's a story... in the book about Norton having a fanatical interest in boxing. There was a character who I think was either the editor or owner of the Northern Territory News who had a similar fascination and who had an argument over a reader's letter being published. And he said to the author of his letter, he said, should we go outside and settle it with the fists? And they did just that with all the editorial staff looking on each of them.
I wish I'd known that story. Yes, no, I hadn't heard that, but he did have a, you know, tremendous interest in boxing. Ezra did, yeah.
Michael.
Sandra, from your examination of truth in those good old days, the halcyon days of truth, what proportion would you think of, A, its readership, and B, its content, would have depended heavily on salacious stuff out of the divorce courts in the days when there was contested divorces? Mm. I mean, I guess I'm wondering to what extent would the change in the divorce laws have destroyed that kind of journalism anyway?
I'm sure that had something to do with it as well, yes. Yes, all that was coming to an end. And, you know, I think that sort of helped to hasten.
So you wouldn't see Crikey as a sort of a inheriting any of that kind of tradition? Not with divorce courts.
Yeah, the opinion, you know, the sort of provocative... it's the same sort of larrikin element that John Norton practiced, I suppose. You know, he used to take off at anything, you know, at a sort of whim. If he decided that somebody was not to his liking, then he'd go for it, hammer and tongs. And, you know, there is that sort of thing about some Crikey and some of the other websites that are springing up that do have that sort of critical edge, I guess.
Sounds like a great book to be turned into a film. Have you thought of it? And who would you like to direct it, and who would play it?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'll have to think about that one for a while. It's more like a television series, I think, really. It's one of those kind of meandering. I think you couldn't do it without having John as well, you know, because there's the context there. Russell Crowe, possibly. Yes, no, I'd have to have a bit of time over that one.
Does Cyril Pearl and you strongly disagree on any matters in terms of Wild Men of Sydney?
I don't know about strongly disagreeing. I think that just the tone is different from, you know, I mean, he really was enraged in that book about John Norton. I didn't have the same, you know, my attitude is more detached, I guess. You know, he really couldn't forgive him for you know, sort of betraying the Labour Party, really, I suppose. Whereas I just saw Norton as a maverick who, you know, you couldn't expect him to be allied to any particular party or group. He's just a force of nature, I think.
I bought your book, I'm yet to read it, but the daughter, Mary.
Yes, well, they certainly... they're very private people. His widow is still alive as well. And,
did you speak to them?
I spoke to Mary, but they didn't want any acknowledgement in the book. They gave me the photographs. They don't mind those being acknowledged, but they don't, you know, they have no wish for it to be seen as in any way an authorised biography, and that suits me fine.
Were they helpful?
Yes, they helped me with faxes, and I didn't... I only met Mary once, and... You know, there were no lengthy interviews or anything, but they answered questions that I had. I mean, obviously, I think his widow would have had... I know she would have had much more to tell, but she didn't choose to tell it. I mean, she's in her 90s, and I think she's not interested in having... you know, in being part of the story being told again.
And Mary's got in her 50s, right?
Mm.
So what does she do?
She's got a family, a young teenage family, and I think they're a bit older now.
And another name.
Mm.
All right, we're getting close to anyone? So there we are. Okay, well, many thanks.
Thank you very much.
Sandra will be back later to talk on Ezra Pounds. Sorry about that, folks. Look, thanks for tonight. I've learnt a lot about John and Ezra and Norton. I didn't know a lot about them. I probably should know more about them, and I've learnt a lot tonight. And certainly it says a lot about Australian society, I think, and the Australian media in particular, but Australian society more generally. It was a different time in those days, and... but it's an important time, and it's an important book. So thanks for coming along tonight. Talk will be up on the pod tomorrow, published in the Sydney papers in due course. Janet Grundy's got some copies of Tabloid Man outside. But for now, many thanks, Sandra. Well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.